This week on the Back Table Podcast.
So whatever, like whatever device gives you the most comfort to get a good sample, that's which device. Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. It doesn't affect us at all. I don't care how you get the sample, as long as it's good. It can, you know.
Yeah, right. If it's in a bucket or if it's from a biopsy device,
it doesn't matter.
Good.
Yeah, it doesn't matter as long as it's there. We always laugh at you guys because you're like, well, my needle was in the lesion. And I was like, well, the lesion's not in the needle.
Well, we're like fighter pilots. Like, we always think we hit. Like, you know, it's always like, hey, look, it's in there. It's in there. It's got to be.
Yeah, oh, and that's how I always joke. And I was like, yeah, I understand that the needle is in the lesion, but the lesion is not in the needle and there's nothing I can do.
That's a really good line.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Back Table Podcast. If you're a new listener, welcome. For all of our regular listeners, welcome back and thank you for listening. You can find all previous episodes of the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or our website, which is backtable.com. Very easy to remember. Subscribe to the show, leave us a review, or reach out to us on social media. Now, a quick word from our sponsor.
For over 50 years, Argonne Medical has remained a dedicated partner to interventionalists through vascular and oncology product solutions that support the drive for exceptional patient outcomes. Argonne is a U.S. manufacturer and innovator that partners with healthcare providers globally to offer solutions like the Option Elite retrievable IVC filter, the cleaner rotational thrombectomy system, and the Biopense Ultra full core biopsy device. Argonne's continual pursuit of better has recently been demonstrated in their launches of the Kodiak Dual Port Coaxial Introducer Kit and SuperCore Advantage semi-automatic biopsy instruments. Learn more about Argonne Medical's mission to improve the lives of patients and caregivers at argonnemedical.com.
And now back to the show.
Hey guys, and welcome to the Back Table Podcast. Today we're going to be, I think the title of this episode is going to be Pathology 101. And to help us with this discussion, I've asked a friend and colleague who works at my hospital in New Orleans, Dr. Andrew Scholl, who is a pathologist and is going to kind of talk about their process and talking about their process, hopefully uncover some tips that interventional radiologists can do to improve what we do. All right, Andrew, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate being on.
Can you just give us like a background of first, like your practice, like how you got to pathology, and then also what the pathology training looks like now? Like, I mean, because we, you know, not that I want to siphon off like med students who are interested in IR, but, you know, just a quick plug for like pathology.
Sure.
What's cool about it?
Pathology is great. It's something you're not really exposed to in med school very often. You just kind of are thrown into the path course and they throw some slides on a microscope, which are poorly prepared. And then they expect you to get the answers right on the test. And, you know, that kind of leaves a sour taste in a lot of med students' mouth. But yeah, it's really neat on the back end. I mean, it's, you know, after med school, you do 4 years of residency and then you go do a fellowship. My subspecialty fellowship was in cytopathology at MD Anderson Hospital. And basically what that means is that you're looking at individual cells on the slide. So that's FNAs and small biopsies like you guys do in IR.
Got it. Is everyone in pathology doing, or a majority of people, fellowship training these days?
Yeah, a majority is at least 1 year of fellowship training, sometimes two, depending on, you know, the job market and stuff.
Okay. What are some of the other fellowships out there? Just curiosity.
Oh, there's a bunch. So
a ton?
You kind of split it into two. So there's the AP, which is anatomic pathology, and then there's the CB, which is clinical pathology. And so the AP is your cells, your biopsies, you know, your slides, your tumors, diagnosing things. And then in the back end, which is where all the lab work is done, which is, you know, CBCs, the blood bank, chemistry. All those tests are overseen by a pathologist on the back end. So there's a sort of big smorgasbord of things that you can do. And within the CP, you know, you have a blood bank fellowship, you have a chemistry fellowship, molecular pathology is becoming very, very popular. And then in the AP, you can subspecialize. So cytopathology, GU, breast, kidney, all these things. So, you know, you kind of do your 4 years of general residency and then you decide, okay, I want to be a subspecialty GU pathologist or long or whatever.
So for the general pathologist coming out, is the, and I'm sure the job market's all over the place, but Is it more that pathologists have to know how to do just about everything? Like, is it better to be well-equipped at a lot of different things and then have your specialty? Or when you're coming out, like, are you almost doing exclusively cytopath?
You know,
like,
no, right the percentage, now,
yeah.
Right now, you really want to be a general pathologist.
Really?
That's for the job market, that's the best place to be, sort of a general AP. So you can do a general surgical pathology fellowship, and that kind of gets you exposure to a whole bunch of different organ systems. And then you can kind of subspecialize within that. So depending on your practice, makeup, who's, you know, doing what kind of thing, I've sort of found myself pigeonholed into GU and breast and then cytopathology as well. So that's sort of how I've subspecialized after practice outside of the fellowship. So, you know, your practice needs, hey, we do a bunch of GU at this institution, so you're going to have to learn how to do it. And then you kind of do a fellowship after yeah, fellowship.
Yeah, the after fellowship.
Yeah, exactly.
Out of curiosity, I like to ask this of other specialties, like, what's the coolest part of the job? And then also, what's the scut, like everyone avoids doing? It's like the leftover at the end of the week.
Well, to be honest, my favorite part of the job is this puzzle, right? So,
yeah,
you know, you get, and you're sort of the first piece of that puzzle. So someone comes in, they have a cough, they get a CT scan. And then there's a lung nodule, right? So the question is it a met? Is it a primary?
Yeah.
What kind of tumor is it? So, you know, you get your needle in there and then I get it on the back end. And so my job is to figure out, okay, this is an adeno versus a squame. What is the molecular profile? What is this? So I'm putting all these pieces together so that the heme-onc doctors can actually come together with a plan to treat that patient. So, you know, I apply immunohistochemistry stains and figure out exactly what that answer is for these guys to treat them appropriately. So that's the fun part for me, is that it's a mystery until it gets on my microscope slide.
That's cool. All right. So on the converse, what's the part that everyone hates to do?
Well, to be honest,
maybe there's nothing. Maybe that's the sell. Everything in pathology is great.
It's a good life, Chris. It really
okay,
is.
Okay. All right. All right.
It's
so
a good life.
So the grass
life.
Is actually greener over in the pathology?
Yeah. I thought I wanted to be a surgeon for the longest time. You know, you sort of had this ideal, oh, I'm going to go to med school and be a surgeon. And then you come to realize, like, oh, but pathology, it's the ultimate answer for these people. So you got a problem to solve, and it's really neat. But I mean, just like you, I think it's the pre-analytical stuff that's kind of problematic, where you got a team of people who got to put together the slides and do it correctly and label everything, and you know, and you got to trust a bunch of people and make sure that what you're seeing under the microscope is actually coming from the right patient, coming from the right laterality.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Yeah, that's something I think that has got to be a bigger problem in the pathology than it is radiology, right? Like, I talk about it all the time with ultrasound, like for diagnostic or for people doing diagnostic ultrasounds over there. You know, if you're reading something, you don't know if the sonographer's taking a picture of their liver or the patient's liver. And
right,
so there's a
right.
lot of trust involved. But as assuming pathology, I mean, you're really relying that, like you said, it's coming from the nodule that they're saying at the
left
location.
Nodule,
from the
right nodule, you know. Because a lot of these people, they got bilateral stuff. And
Sure. That's pretty funny. Okay, so let's get into it. So I just want to set the groundwork for my biopsy practice, or just like the biopsy side of things, and that way lay some groundwork. So at our institution, interventional radiology does a large majority of the biopsies, like, of course, excluding excisional biopsies. But for the percutaneous biopsies, it's mostly interventional radiology, the breast radiologist, and then we have a smattering like that come from Neil Niden, like he's interventional pull, right? Where else do you see some of the small tissue biopsies coming from, like at Touro?
You guys do most of the thyroid FNA. Sometimes we see those come from the endocrinologist across the street.
Right.
But yeah, Neil's doing EBUS, Joshi, and a few
he's
of those.
GI.
Yeah,
GI.
GI. So the GI guys will, you know, do an endoscopy and do FNAs and cores of pancreatic head masses and that sort of stuff.
And so I'll just say that at our practice, and it can vary from provider to provider, we do 18-gauge cores of just about everything with the exception of lung, where it's either going to be a 20 or an 18-gauge, and that can vary depending on operator experience, comfort, and what we're biopsying. Like if we think architecture is needed, if we think it's adenocarcinoma in situ, then we try and push for bigger biopsies. All our thyroids, I want to say all of our thyroids that we do coming from IR FNAs, but I think some of my partners are core, maybe a combination of cores and FNAs. But I just mean to say that in general, we're coring most of what we do, and FNAs are reserved for thyroids. Can you speak anything
what
to
size like needles what are you typically using for your thyroids?
25 gauge as recommended by
yes.
you. Okay.
yeah.
All
excellent.
Right. You want to comment on that at all? Because like my partners, I don't know if they've really like bought
no,
into
I mean,
like,
well, yeah, I think some of them are just using that core needle and then just like scraping it on a slide and calling it an FNA.
Yes, exactly.
So I don't know what size they're using.
20 gauge.
20. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it that can make it bloody. And to be honest, the cores of the thyroids, they're not really helpful because things fall apart. You're not getting, you know, the architecture. And within the subspecialty cytopathology, you know, you have these parameters that you use to put it into these Bethesda categories. And when you have chunks of core on a slide that just totally mucks up the Bethesda category. And so it's blood and tissue fragments. And really, you want that nice, fine 25 gauge smear on those slides to kind of apply the Bethesda.
So let me ask you this, because this actually comes up, and I don't know if it's all that common knowledge, but like if you have like a 20 gauge or let's say even an 18 gauge core of a thyroid nodule, I mean, like, is there any way to get, like, say we've taken it, and then I know that some people will smear it around a slide and then they call it an FNA, but is there any way to extract like smaller cells from a bigger core? Or you have what you have? And
yeah, you kind of have what you have, but I mean,
okay.
Smearing it on a slide, it does it, but you know, the thing with the papillary thyroid carcinoma is that you're using, you know, nuclear features and architectural features, and those are best coming out on a slide from an FNA and not so much from a core that's just full of blood.
Okay. So any advantage at all to taking a core of a thyroid biopsy?
I find none because the way that you're categorizing these is utilizing, you know, years and years of categorization via Bethesda on a cytology smear. And so the cores, you know, yeah, they might have some papillary architecture. Yeah, they might have that, but you were going to get that from the FNA anyway. And, you know, when you're looking at follicular lesions, adenoma versus carcinoma, it's the capsule that you're really worried about, but you're not getting a capsule on a core. So again, that doesn't help you further categorize any of these lesions. So the PTC that you were going to see on the cytology is not going to be enhanced by the core in any way. So I actually discourage cores as much as possible.
Well, that's why, I mean, and so hold on, how about this? So why 25 gauge? Why not like 23, 21, or 27? 25
those
is
all,
just like that goalie.
Yeah, 25, 27, 23 is fine. Sometimes those nodules are a little bit more fibrous. And to get through that sort of fibrosis, you need a 23,
yeah.
Kind of push through it, and that's fine. I don't discourage that, but you know, 2018, that's too big.
Well, I'll tell you, like, I think a lot of interventional radiologists, so like the way we train, it's kind of like you're left with like the general sense that bigger is better.
Yeah.
And then also like you may go through a training program for interventional radiology and you may not actually do a lot of thyroid FNAs, just because like that complexity is kind of low. And so you may spend your time training, doing these other different procedures, and then you have to do a lot of thyroid FNAs in actual like private practice. And so actually, you actually...
Is it just kind of ingrained in your head that a core, you know, just...
Yeah,
core.
Yeah, core equals better.
Right.
Is like really like... And so that's what I kind of wanted to get at today is that like, hey, man, that's not always the case.
No, it's not.
Yeah. But I will say, just so everyone knows, it's not like I knew this inherently, like my practice changed whenever you came and kind of gave us a pathology crash course about like, hey, just do the smaller gauge needles, you're going to get better core, or you're going to get better FNAs and better.
You get better stuff. Oh, they look fantastic at Touro now. They really
do.
Yeah. Well, they talk about getting blood in the hub too. And that drives me insane because the first piece of the specimen that's coming up is going to come through that needle. It's going to get up into the hub and then everything in front of it is just blood.
Okay.
So like the blood in the hub is actually the sample. And then when you put it down on the slide, you're just pushing the blood that was in the tip of the needle onto the slide.
Yeah. So you don't need any of the blood.
You don't want the blood. You want the sample. And the sample, you know, so I always advocate that don't stay in a lesion longer than 10 seconds. I don't care if you see blood in the hub or not, because the sample is going to be in that needle.
Okay. And so when you're saying blood in the hub, like just for like people who may not have a perfect visual on this, so you have a 25 gauge needle. I usually hook it up to the back of a syringe, like,
sure.
You know, a three or five cc syringe. but just stay in the nodule long enough. You don't have to see blood return into the hub of the needle. You just stay in it for 5-10 seconds and then put it, whatever else, put that onto the slide.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And that's the best way to do it.
Okay. That's a good tip. See, we're already getting into it. All right. So let's get out a little bit out of thyroid FNAs and get in a little bit to core biopsies. But once a biopsy is taken, whether it's interventional pull, GI, or more likely IR, you know, the pros, can you talk a little bit about what happens when we put it into, or actually talk about like the different ways you can send out a sample? Because you don't just have to put in formalin and you have options. And when does it change? Like, it may not be formalin, which is kind of the default, I would say.
Yeah, formalin is typically the default. Usually you need some sort of clinical history in order to triage things. I mean, if you're going into a lymph node who's in a patient who's got, you know, lymphadenopathy and you're thinking lymphoma, you got to not put some in formalin so you can get some flow cytometry out of that sample.
Now, why can't you get flow cytometry out of a formalin sample? I mean, I know that you can't. I just never really knew why.
So formalin fixation crosslinks proteins. And once those proteins are sort of crosslinked, they stick together. Flow is a procedure in which each individual cell has to flow in a laminar fashion through an aperture. And you attach different, you know, signals to those cells. And then a laser kind of reads, okay, this is signal X and this is signal Y. So this is a B cell, this is a T cell, this is a macrophage. And so if you have cross-linked those proteins, they're not going to flow through that aperture. And so that's why you need a fresh sample where you can have individual cells that are still alive and healthy in the flow cytometer.
Okay. So whatever you're getting a sample, and you think you have a lymphoma, you have a high pretest probability, what's the preferred? Because I've done different things with them, RPMI, just having fresh sample on like a wet TELFA pad. Like, what's the preferred?
Immediately into RPMI is
immediately
is
into RPMI.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean you're going to want to fix some too. So you're going to want formalin fix and RPMI. But yeah, into RPMI, which is basically a cell culture medium that just keeps the cells alive.
Got it. So what is it about? Like, so why do we put everything in formalin? Why is that like the? Why is that the default? Like, what's so great about formalin? Like, why aren't we just putting everything in saline?
So tissue after being exposed to air.
I feel like you're like thinking about like a way that you can like actually dumb this down for like interventional radiologists that are listening. For people who don't see the audio, like Andrew, like kind of like looked up to the sky and was like, "How can I explain this?
How can I explain this?" So I mean, basically, you know, tissue dies when it's left away from its blood supply, and in order to preserve architecture and the integrity of that tissue, you need to cross-link the proteins, cross-link the DNA, the RNA in that specimen. And formalin is a substance that basically cross-links proteins and DNA, RNA in the cells, in the individual cells. And so that preserves the architecture. And in that process, basically a water molecule is produced. So you're kicking out water and cross-linking proteins. And that's what's going to preserve that specimen for a long period of time so it can be processed and put under a microscope. So lung, for example. So, you know, lung has alveolar spaces. It's got the interstitium. It's got the blood vessels in there. So if you let that sit on a TELFA pad, it's all going to sort of disintegrate. The alveolar spaces are going to collapse. The tissue's kind of going to degrade. And then the architecture that, you know, we as a pathologist require to see, okay, this is an alveolar space. This is a tumor cell. This is a, you know, pneumocyte. This is a blood vessel. That just sort of melts into itself. And so the formalin is what allows that architecture and that integrity to be there.
So in terms of samples, and I know it's hard to paint everything with a broad brush, but I just want to see like kind of where this takes us. But the way I think about it is bigger samples are better. And that means not only by gauge, but on length. But I want to get your thoughts on that. Like, so, you know, yeah, outside of thyroids.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, bigger is better. All right.
Yeah, bigger is absolutely better when you're talking about cores of tissue. And so, you know, your trade-off is, am I going to give this person a pneumo? Am I going to, you know, give this person a hemothorax? So, yeah, bigger is always better.
And okay, so all things being equal, bigger is better.
Yeah, if you can get a bigger sample safely, then you absolutely have to do that.
and more samples, always better.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How about like if you're getting though, like, is it ever, so sometimes like I'll take 10 or 12 cores. And the reason I'm doing this is sometimes like I'm in a big lung lesion and I feel like the needle, like, you know, I'll be a little bit too central. And so I'm getting what appears to me, you know, on
necrotic stuff.
Kind of necrotic. Or I just feel like I'm not getting a good sample, but I'm putting it all into the same formula. And so I end up with like 12 passes, but, you know, maybe only three or four of those are like really good tan white tissue. Is like, sometimes I think like, would it be better if you separated out, you know, the quote unquote good passes for the quote unquote bad passes into two different containers? Okay. All right. Talk about that a little bit in that.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're getting 12 cores and say seven of them are bad.
Yes. Like little shitty kind of mushy fragmented. Yeah.
So in that sense, if you put that into one single formalin container, the processing of that sample has to go through a fixation process. We basically embed it with paraffin, and then it has to be put in a flat plane into a mold where then we cut sections on it. So those tiny little cores, they're not 2D, they're 3D, right? So they kind of flow up and down a little bit, and getting 12 pieces on the same plane is much harder than getting four good ones, right? So if you feel that, you know, your first couple passes are bad, put those in one container formalin, and then the good ones
are
separate.
Right.
Yeah, if you separate them out, then you can get the good stuff in a single plane much easier than trying to combine good and bad cores into a single cassette.
Okay. How about if you have a big lesion, and so all things being equal, you can get into any component of it safely. Is it at all helpful to have, like, let's say we're in liver, a little bit of what looks like, by imaging, normal liver on the periphery? Like, if you're getting into a lesion, and I don't think it's necrotic, so I can either bullseye it, and what you get is all core, all tumor, or I can get a little bit to the side and give you 90% core, a little bit on the periphery, or, you know, maybe 20% healthy liver and then 80% tumor. Like, does any of that make a difference?
Yeah, I think it would.
Okay.
I didn't know that you really could be that precise with it.
We're like snipers. not always. And sometimes you can't be. But then sometimes, so, like, you have total control of the situation, and that is totally possible.
The way that our brain works is that, you know, the first thing that I look at when I get a slide is what's the specimen, right? So is it lung? Is it liver? So my brain can turn on, you know, what is the background supposed to look like, right?
Okay.
And so when my brain can turn on like what the background's supposed to look like, then I can, it's much easier for me to pick out stuff that's not appropriate or not supposed to be there, right? So, you know, same thing with you when you're looking at a lung, like, you know,
you want
to top to bottom what the, you know, what the, what it looks like. And, you know, okay, there's a lesion there. It comes up and it disappears. So that's not a vessel. It's not part of the, you know, it's not part of the normal background lung process. So you can see it. So the same sort of thought process works for the pathologist as well, in that if I know you're supposed to be in liver, okay, that is not a bile duct, that is not a hepatocyte. And so it helps me. So in that sense, if you are as good as you claim you can be,
sometimes,
then having a little bit of background liver in there would be helpful, because then when I want to categorize that type of tumor, so is it HCC? Is it a, you know, metastatic colon? Is it something? So we have stains that we can put on it, and I know that a hepatocyte doesn't stain with this, whereas a tumor would. And so if I have that background benign liver there that picks up the stain in the expected manner, then A, I know it worked, and B, I know that the tumor is in fact real staining for, you know, this colon cancer marker. So yeah, having normal stuff back there is super duper helpful. It's like, you know, we call it an internal control. Like TTF is an immunostain that we use, for example, that's a marker of lung. If you have a metastatic lung and it goes to the liver, the TTF will stay in the nuclei of the lung tumor positive. But what's interesting about hepatocytes is that the cytoplasm of the hepatocytes takes up that TTF1. So I can see in the background that that TTF1 is staining the hepatocytes in a granular cytoplasmic way appropriately and the tumor in the nucleus appropriately. So I know that my stain worked, it covered the tumor, and it's a real positive stain.
Got it. Right. Rather than a false positive. So it's like an internal control there.
Yeah. Okay. And the internal control is super helpful if you guys are that good.
Like I said, depends on the day, depends on the doc. All right. So we said bigger is better. How about, and I know it's hard to say, but like if you're getting good, high quality samples, how many samples would you say, like what's the bare minimum? What's like, all right, you got it. That's fantastic. And then what's like, all right, man, if you're taking 20 great cores, I just don't need that many. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I bet it's, if I had to guess, it's probably on a spectrum. Like too few is too bad. Too many, it's like.
I mean, if you're, you know, how long are your cores? They're a centimeter long, basically.
Let's say 2 centimeter cores, 2 centimeter 18 inch cores.
2 centimeter cores. Yeah, you need three.
Three.
You need 3 to 4 to do what you need to do, like in a lung tumor.
And that includes next gen sequencing?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So two of those I'll need for, you know, the diagnosis, and then the two can go for PD-L1, next gen sequencing, you know, all the adenocarcinoma, BRAF, whatever you need. Yeah, four. Let's say four.
Okay, let's say four. All right. Yeah, like there's IRs like across the country that are listening to this, and they're going to take it to like their pathologist at different hospitals. Like,
oh, no.
Andrew Schultz said this.
Four. Four good ones.
Yeah, four good ones. I think that's the caveat.
Yeah.
Okay, that's helpful to know. I mean, I think it just puts people like in the ballpark. And can you talk a little bit about, I mean, because I feel like next-gen sequencing now is, how about this? Let me frame the question in, is next-gen sequencing always getting sent out? Is it like a reflex send-out, or do you always have to like save some cores getting saved for potentially sending out for molecular markers?
So the way that we've been doing it, I think you've been doing it now too, is that you've been putting a few cores in one container and then a few cores in another.
Right. I've been separating the two different.
And that is helpful because, you know, the first two cores we're using to get to the name, right? So the name is adenocarcinoma, or the name is metastatic renal cell carcinoma.
Got it.
And then that second block can be saved for the next gen sequencing. And those, for the most part, are PCR-based tests where they're amplifying the DNA in that specimen and then using it to find all of these different mutations, whether it's HER2, BRAF, KRAS, you know, NRAS, all of these things that potentially have therapeutic direct, you know, meanings going forward. So what I wanted to say is that it's important to have that specimen available for you. And the way we're going now is that all these patients are getting it. It's not reflex as of right now because there's so many mutation possibilities. So, you know, there's a next gen for breast, there's a next gen for kidney, there's a next gen for whatever. And so you have to have a name before you can send it out at this point in time.
Yeah. Got it. So my thought on that, just to back up the audience, is because there's some, you know, things that me and Andrew know that I just want to update you on. So originally we were doing some biopsies and everything went in one formalin container. And we were coming back with some, it wasn't non-diagnostic. We were getting a name, but then we didn't have enough tissue for next-gen sequencing. And so then we changed our process. I think it was y'all's suggestion that we put them in two separate formalin containers. And that way you could use one for the diagnosis and then two for the send out. Yeah. All right, do all those, like whenever we say send out, like where do y'all send it? Like where do these things go?
Yeah, I mean, there are these big labs that have these large PCR machines that they can run at volume.
Okay, so it's not like any place has these in-house, like if you're at like MD Anderson or something.
No, but a place like that would have this
all right,
in-house.
Anderson does.
Yeah. Yes, but where we're at, or you know, a rural hospital, whatever, they're going to have to send it to a big lab to get these tests done.
Anywhere in Louisiana, like are there any hospitals that actually that do their own? I mean, I know you don't know all the hospitals. But do you have to have the scale of like a big center?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, what's happened is that, you know, it requires these big expensive machines that, you know, need to be running basically 24/7 in order to make it profitable based on reimbursement. So
you have to have the volume.
So you got to have a volume. Yeah. And so these big labs have just you know, bought five machines and are running them 24/7 from around the state. Yeah.
I want to talk to you a little bit about biopsy devices. And I'm just curious, like from a pathologist perspective, can you ever tell, I mean, surely you can tell the difference between whether we're using an FNA or a core, but can you tell the difference between like when we give you an 18 gauge versus a 20 gauge core?
Yeah, I can tell the difference. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like in theory, like if you had a side cutting needle, for some reason, if we thought like, because in IR, there's kind of not a, it's not like a big debate, because a lot of times your biopsy device is dictated by where you're biopsying, operator preference, critical
sure.
structures nearby. But, you know, sometimes in some situations, you'd prefer to use a side cutting needle or like a notched needle.
Okay.
But from your perspective, that looks like if it's an 18 gauge, 18 gauge is pretty close. Because in theory, like the full core would actually get a fuller core.
It's the same size. So it's really more about what your preference is and what you feel you can get in there and get a good specimen.
Right. So whatever device gives you the most comfort to get a good sample, that's which device. Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. It does. It's, as long as it's there.
Yeah.
We always laugh at you guys because you're like, well, my needle was in the lesion. And I was like, well, the lesion's not in the needle.
Well, we're like fighter pilots. Like we always think we hit. Like, you know, it's always like, hey, look, it's in there. It's in there. It's got to be.
Yeah. Oh, and that's how I always joke. And I was like, I understand that the needle is in the lesion, but the lesion is not in the needle and there's nothing I can do.
That's a really good line.
Yeah.
How about the difference between like, what GI and interventional PULM is giving, like are their samples any different? Like, because I think they'll use like a 20 gauge sometimes, like, but I think they do different, like, you know, advanced techniques, like a cryo freeze then to pull it out or something.
Given that they are accessing lesions that are deep via an endoscope and an ultrasound probe, the cores have to be small. And to be honest, what I've found, and I'm probably biased because I am trained as a cytopathologist, I would prefer they just FNA them. I really would. Particularly the pancreas.
Really?
Particularly the pancreas. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like, that probably draws like an important point here, like drill down on, like that's your, like, so you, that's what you would definitely prefer, but like, it's good to open up a lot of communication with your pathologist and say like, you know, what's going to help you get the best answer? Cause
yeah, no, that's absolutely true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that answer can vary, but.
And, you know, some of these lesions, particularly the fibrotic ones in the pancreas, to get cells out of there, it's just better to use a 22, 23 gauge endoscopy needle and FNA it. Yeah. Because, I mean, a lot of the times, too, you got chronic pancreatitis in the background and you just got, you know, you just got fibrosis on the cores and it's not very helpful.
Yeah. So this kind of gets to a point. When is it that, because I think, like, how certain do you have to be to then put out a pathology report that says this is the answer? Because, you know, sometimes it says non-diagnostic, maybe we need, you know, it'll make like a different recommendation. And maybe that varies from practitioner to practitioner, but I mean, like, even like in straightforward cases, it's probably hard to be like 100% certain. But like, when I think about like radiology, you know, in diagnostic radiology, there's always like that out that some radiologists will say like, oh, correlate clinically, or maybe if we had like a MRI,
sure.
super secret MRI or something, but like you guys don't really have much of an out other than saying, hey, we need more tissue, but you have to have like some degree of certainty to like then say like, this is the diagnosis. Treatment recommendations are based on like what you guys say.
Yeah. So
how certain,
that harkens back to how good is the biopsy, right? So when I hedge that typically falls into, you know, one or two categories. So you basically have benign, atypical, suspicious, and malignant. That's sort of the big four that we're falling into, right? So when I fall into the atypical and suspicious categories, it's usually because I don't have enough tissue. That's usually what it comes down to. So I'll have a lung cancer. It's on the, there's tiny stuff on the edge. I can't do any immunostains on it because it will disappear. And if I do immunostains, then they're not, the cells are not there anymore. And so my hedge is that I know this is non-small cell cancer, but I can't call it squam. I can't call it adeno. I can't call it a met. So it sort of falls into the, I know it's cancer, but I can't tell you anything more than that.
Like,
yeah. And that, that makes it sometimes difficult for the hematologist, oncologist to sort of treat.
Sometimes I feel like samples can get sent out, and not necessarily for next-gen sequencing, but like you can send them out like for a second opinion. What, is everyone's threshold different for that? Or like
everyone's how, like, threshold is different, but I mean, I can speak to my threshold. My threshold is this looks like tumor X, but the immunostain stain like tumor Y, and I don't have a name for it, right? So that, you know, there's plenty of tissue there, but the name that I want to put on it doesn't have enough supporting evidence, whether it's immunostains or flow or whatever, to put that name, you know, rubber stamp that name on it. So that's when I will sort of step back and say, okay, you know, the tumor looks like an adeno, but it stains like a squamous, or it, you know, it looks like this, but it stains like a kidney, but the guy's got a history of colon. And so, you know, that when the clinical picture doesn't sort of fit with what's on the slide, that's another reason for me to kind of step back and say, I'm not sure what I'm doing here. Let me send this out somewhere where they can do, you know, sort of more advanced testing, whether that's next gen sequencing or more immunostains that I don't have access to.
Okay. So is that sometimes the case? It's not necessarily like, I'm framing it like this, at like kind of a caricature, but it's not like, oh, Dr. Scholl's brain is too small, so he has to have someone else think about it. But like people have access to different tools that you just, if you're at a, that you just don't have access to.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, so as an example, they will do brain tumor, you know, biopsies, excisions at our institution. And the way that these brain tumors are now categorized is whether they're IDH1 mutant or not. And then, so the glioneoplasms, they need these tests in order to categorize them that I just don't have access to. So I know it's a glioneoplasm. I know it's a high-grade glioneoplasm. But in terms of categorizing it, I don't have the tools at hand to do that. And so I just, you know, it's cheaper for me to send it out to a higher end neuropathology institution that has an IDH1 immunostain
sitting,
or
that's sitting there on the counter, I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
So the other question I wanted to get at was how much history, like, and I think each place can vary. And it, do you work at some different sites, like other than Turo? Like,
We sign out stuff all over the state.
Okay, great. So this is good. So I would imagine the amount of like information that you have about a sample can vary widely.
Yes.
Like, okay, can you talk about that and how that makes a difference? And if that makes a big difference, or you're like, look, just give me the sample. And you know what? I'll whether I have, you know, dog shit or whether I have like filet mignon, like I can tell you what it's going to be.
So as much clinical history as you can possibly give me is absolutely important. So for example, you know, you always hear this, oh, I don't want to bias my pathologist, right? So are you not going to bias me by just not telling me where the sample came from? Like, I got to figure it out on my own. So that just wasted 10 minutes of my time to figure out that, you know, Dr. Beck sent me a liver core and not a lung core. It makes a huge difference for my brain to figure out what I need to be looking for and what the differential diagnosis in my head is, right? So if you're doing a kidney mass, I have a catalog of kidney tumors in my head. And so I need as much information as possible, right? So, you know, you're doing a core of a lung, right? But the guy's got a history of colon cancer. He's got a history of renal cell cancer, you know, so that can help me immensely get to the right answer. Whereas if my differential is everything, inflammatory, neoplastic, possibly, you know, the guy traveled to, you know, Kenya. Pneumoconiosis. It's just like, if that's the differential, I can't possibly get to a meaningful answer in a reasonable amount of time with the material that you're providing me, right? So four cores. Okay. So if I have four cores to figure out neoplasm of unknown origin, inflammatory lesion of unknown origin, bacteria/fungus of unknown origin, I'm lost. I'm not going to be able to give you a good answer. But if I know as much clinical history as possible, I can narrow down what I need to figure out quickly and accurately.
Got it. Okay. That's kind of what I suspected.
Yeah, I love clinical history. Because, well, you know, and the other thing too is that, you know, when you're asked to do a biopsy, you want to know pretest probabilities of it. Is this going to be malignant? Is this going to be lymphoma? Does the guy have lymphadenopathy elsewhere? Does he have a history of Hodgkin when he was 15 years? You know, there are all these things that help you triage that specimen that you're going to get. And then on the back end, it's the same way that we're dealing with it too. Because, you know, if the guy's got a history of Hodgkin, I don't want you to waste stuff on float because Hodgkin doesn't flow, right? So these are all things where, like, I just wasted four cores flowing on a guy with a history of Hodgkin. That's not a meaningful test in that clinical scenario, right? So the better information we have before, the better the diagnosis is going to be at the back end.
Okay. What are the things that, like, interventional radiologists will say, or one of the things I was taught is, like, you biopsy your infections and you culture your tumors, in meaning that almost in all scenarios, whether you think it's a tumor or infection, you're going to get a culture, kind of.
Yes.
You know, you're
yes.
in the same thing with, if you think it's an infection, you biopsy it. Do you see the cultures? And, like, do you find that helpful? Like, are there ever situations where, like, you know, I you know, interventional radiology thinks, like, it's a primary lung tumor, and then you get all these cores back, and you're like, man, they didn't send any of this for culture?
Oh, yeah, it drives me crazy.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, for example, last week we had an orbital tumor that was biopsied, and he thought it was a tumor. He thought it could be, you know, whatever, and then I put it on the microscope, and it's granulomatous inflammation. I better go check the EMR and see if there's cultures in there. And you look and you're like, well, there could be an acid fast bacillus in there. But the sensitivity of a tissue and a stain is so much smaller than a culture, right? So yeah, that saying is absolutely, I will go to the EMR and look and see if a culture has been done all the time. Well, and the other thing too, is that it's particularly in lung, you know, you get those obstructive lesions and you'll get a pneumonia behind it. And, you know, so the needle might be in the pneumonia, but you're going to treat the tumor and you're also going to treat the pneumonia, right? So in that instance, it's important to get both. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because, like, I sometimes, like, you see on the pathology report where you guys do actually make a lot of comments about an infectious etiology, like if cultures aren't sent, it's always like, I kind of read those. I'm like, oh, well, looks like they got it. They figured it out. It's not infectious. But, like, what you're saying is you're doing the best with what you have, but having a culture would have been very nice.
Oh, I mean, okay. You know, I could put a gram stain on a core, but it's going to tell you gram positive cocci.
Yeah, yeah.
And then your ID doc is going to call you and be like,
can you get me any further?
anything else? Right. And then they're going to, you know, because they need to know sensitivities and all that sort of stuff on the bug that's there. And all I can tell them is that it's a gram positive cocci, you know?
Okay. Okay. Fair statement. So going back to, like, primary liver tumor, primary kidney tumor, I guess it was always my understanding that HCC or renal cell can kind of be difficult to diagnose, like from a pathology side, but maybe that's kind of incorrect, or maybe that's old thinking.
Hepatocellulars are a little bit more difficult, particularly the well-differentiated ones. And that's again, where the pre-analytical clinical history is going to be absolutely immense, right? So this guy's got cirrhosis. He's got HCV for 20 years. You know, my pretest probability for a hepatocellular carcinoma is going to be much higher, and therefore I can sort of work harder to get to that diagnosis, because HCC, it doesn't stain differently from benign hepatocytes in that I don't have as many tools at my disposal to categorize HCC versus, like, a MET, for example. So I have to work a little bit harder on the back end to get to that diagnosis. And so having that, you know, pretest probability is super helpful for me to get to, you know, well diff HCC on my diagnostic line.
Okay. What about for kidney tumors? Because what we talk about, like, on the biopsy side is that, you know, you may have like a renal cell with oncocytic features, or you're just, for us, like some, we just talk about sampling error, but I was curious, like if it, like as long as you have a good sample in the right part of the tuber, you think it's straightforward, or?
For the most part, yes. I think the tricky part about renal tumors though, is that there is so much overlap, clear cell with oncocytic features, chromophobe, oncocytoma. So those things require a little bit more background architecture to sort of better differentiate. I mean, there's immunostains that can help you in that setting, but the architecture is helpful. And then, you know, as you know, the tricky thing with renal tumors is they're highly vascular. So, you know, you'll stick that core in there and then it'll just kind of turn into a mush of blood. And so from an interventional perspective, coring of kidney tumors is just technically difficult. And then on the back end, it's pretty hard to categorize them unless you have a very, very good sample.
Just thinking about like specialty situations is sometimes we're doing biopsies of like native kidneys or native livers. I never run any problems with native livers, but sometimes native kidneys seem to be difficult to get diagnostic samples. Can you speak a little bit about that, like what you see on your end? I mean, like you would, like people talk about it ad nauseum, like interventional radiologists about glomeruli, or are you seeing the right number of glomeruli? How many gloms did you get?
And yeah.
Maybe the gloms change based on the disease process. Like, I wouldn't pretend to know enough about it, but I was curious, like, what's your thoughts on native kidneys?
When y'all do the native kidneys, we'll look at the cores under a dissecting microscope, and we have a very good one at our institution. So it's helpful to have a good dissecting microscope.
And that's not always the case?
That's not always the case. Yeah, I mean, there were places where people would just take the eyepiece from their, you know, microscope and just try to look at the kidney, and it's just having the right tools to see the glomeruli is actually super duper important. We're lucky enough in our group to have a medical renal pathologist who, and you do not see that very often, you know, outside places. That's difficult to come by. And so because we're lucky enough to have that, she can sort of make cake out of things that are out of ingredients that aren't necessarily
vinegar.
Yeah. So that being said, if you can see the glomeruli, you can make sure that it's adequate before you guys take the needle out, number one. And then number two, the tricky part with medical kidney is that, you know, there are these diseases that require electron microscopy, immunofluorescence, as well as just formalin fixation. So I'm taking those cores and I'm splitting them up into these three, you know, special processes that will give you the best diagnosis. So as someone who has dealt with this before and has a medical renal pathologist on staff, we know, okay, I need this many gloms to put into EM. I need this many for IF, and then the rest goes into light microscopy. And that triage up front is super duper helpful for her into getting that good final diagnosis. But you just don't have that at a lot of institutions where you have a good dissecting microscope, you have someone who knows what a glomerulus looks like, and then can, you know, divvy it up appropriately. Like you know, they might miss some glomeruli and put that in EM, and then you can't, you know, diagnose minimal change disease, right? So that's the tricky part about it, is that medical kidney has a minimal number of glomeruli and three very specific essential tests on the back end that are required to make that final diagnosis.
Is there anything that like an IR doc can do to make sure that they're getting, like, is there any, I mean, and I know there's plenty of things that like I can advise another interventional radiologist to do, but is there anything that you can see on your end that would translate into us like getting a better core for you?
It's more of like, are you guys getting the needle through the cortex and getting, you know, nice glomeruli in the cortex and maybe a little bit of medulla, you know, that it's really the angle of the needle going into the kidney to make sure that you maximize the compartments, the anatomic locations to get the glomeruli out of as many or as in as few cores as you possibly can.
Gotcha. Is there like a number of glomeruli that is like a minimum threshold? Because you'll hear people say different things that, and what I suspect is, the answer is like, it kind of just depends. Sometimes you need fewer glomeruli to get to the answer, and then sometimes you need more glomeruli.
More is better, always.
Yeah, more is better.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, because again, you know,
we
when you
probably call that that could be the name of the podcast.
More is
better. More is better. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you know, when you're divvying things up, you sort of have to triage it. But if you have a ton of glomeruli, then divvying it up is easy, right? And then you don't have to worry about, oh, should I put a little bit extra into the immunofluorescent fixative, or should I put a little bit more into the EM, or, you know, oh, I don't have enough, so I'm going to skip the EM and hope that it's not minimal change disease. You know what I mean? So
Got it.
Yeah. So the more you get, the
better.
Easier it is, man.
How do you guys prefer to receive those samples? Like, is it any different process?
Yeah, just on a Telfa pad.
Telfa pad.
Oh, yeah. A saline wet.
Yeah,
saline
soaked Telfa pad.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right. What I wanted to leave you with, like, Andrew, is kind of an open-ended, like, is there anything that you have wanted to tell, like, interventional radiologists, interventional pulmonologists, or whatever about, like, hey, this would just be general advice for proceduralists, people who are taking biopsies, getting biopsies, to have a conversation with their pathologist, and these are the things that you should talk about, or any, like, just open-ended advice that would be helpful?
Yeah, I think the advice is I would like more history. I know that you guys don't always have that, but it would be helpful to, on the requisition, just say, you know, history of colon, like, you know, if you're FNAing or coring along and the guy's got a history of renal cell cancer, you know, just tell me something, just anything.
No, just, you've already said too much, Andrew.
Just tell me something.
We're going to cut this.
And then the more you can get as safely as you can get it is always better. It's always better for us. More is better. And like I said, of the four categories, the benign, the atypical, the suspicious, and the malignant, the reason I'm in the atypical and suspicious categories is not typically a pathologist problem, it's a specimen problem. And that's where, you know, you sort of fall into, I just needed a little bit more to get to that category that you guys are looking for.
All right. Well said. The one thing I'll leave the audience with is that I wanted to have this conversation with Andrew because I thought it would be immensely helpful to have a pathology perspective. But just on the other end of things, I'll just say that the times I've actually talked with you and some of the pathology colleagues, it's always been very eye-opening. A lot of times it's led to practice changes and to, you know, the positive for our patients. And so if you're an interventional radiologist, you've never reached out to your pathology department, what's the worst that can happen? Give it a go. You may... at the very least, learn that you have a very cool colleague on the other end of the line, but more likely you'll end up with different set of procedures or processes that are going to lead to better patient outcomes or diagnoses.
I think it's good to go back to that different pathologists have different subspecialties,
sure, right.
Are comfortable with different things. And so, you know, myself, I'd prefer that my colleagues FNA the pancreatic head, whereas, you know, some people are just not comfortable with that and they prefer, you know, a different specimen. And so I think to get your patients the best answer that they can possibly get, it would be worthwhile for you to go and just chat with your pathologist and say, hey, you know, what's your subspecialty? What are you comfortable with? What is best for you to get out of the atypical categories and into more definitive places?
Nice. Well said. All right, guys, I think that's going to wrap things up for this podcast. Andrew, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
Jacob Fleming,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhorter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
and Ness Smith-Savadoff.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Article and transcript support by Taylor Robinson
and Delaney Aguilar.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang.
Administrative support provided by Jim Willie Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.